Welcome to the 11KBW podcast on contract law for employment lawyers by Richard Leeper. This talk was given at the 11KBW Employment Law Conference on the 16th of May 2016. For more podcasts and information, please visit 11kbw.com.
Chris was talking about it, not knowing the court you're going to get. The very first question that the Court of Appeal asked in Keenan Comets Bank was this. Is it right that Mr. Keane signed his affidavit on the shores of Lake Geneva? Which he did, because that's where he lived. But we had an inkling then that it wasn't going to go our way. my part in Pacharel was limited, of course, with Chris leading me. It was limited to knowing that Order 14 is now Part 24. I just want to add one other thing, that just before the lunch break, Tom assigned to me the view that lawyers are being more frequently sued, and so as we have to get used to that concept, people in the city are going to have to get used to adverse references. I must emphasise that that isn't something I'm expressing from any particular experience on my own part. I'm going to talk about a bit of contract law for employment lawyers. I'm not going to read out title for you. I'm just going to cover a number of topics, but we'll spend a bit more time on the first, which is the penalty rule, partly because I was in the case, so I know something about it. And it is the case of Cavendish. When he handed down judgment in this, Lord Sumption said this: the underlying rationale for the penalty rule has been misunderstood. Immediately after hand down, the reaction of Mr. Beavis, whose case was joined with Cavendish, as reported in the Daily Mail, so it must be true, what the heck are we going to do about this? What is excessive? That's my question. Unfortunately, it isn't the relevant question. The relevant question now has been handed down in the judgment of Lords Neuberger and Sumption, which in most respects can be taken as the majority judgment. So when they say the true test is, that is the true test. There are slightly different formulations by Lord Mance, Lord Hodge, but it is these two paragraphs which are the nub of the case. The true test is whether the impugn provision is a secondary obligation which imposes a detriment on the contract breaker out of all proportion to any legitimate business of the innocent party in the enforcement of the primary obligation. The innocent party can have no proper interest in simply punishing the defaulter. His interest is in performance or in some appropriate alternative to performance. A number of things to note. It is the penalty rule. There was a change, there was a shift in the language. We'd all talked about the penalty doctrine. It is a rule, which I think was deliberately intended slightly to downplay it. There is a reference to three things: a secondary obligation, a legitimate business interest in enforcing the primary obligation, and thirdly, this language of proportionality, which creeps into more and more of the jurisprudence. And this language is not there, the language of extravagance, of exorbitancy, even of excess, I'm afraid, Mr. Beavis. But also, there's no reference to deterrence. So that language, it does appear particularly in Lord Mance, who has a rather, no disrespect him, but rather an old school approach to this. It appears in his judgment, but for the majority in Neuberger and Sumption, that language is to be consigned to the past. The key facts were briefly this: there was a transfer of shares under a sale and purchase agreement by one of the most influential Lebanese business leaders to a company within the WPP group. In return for money, which was payable in stages, there was a completion payment. That was only $34 million. Then there were going to be interim payments and final payments. The sums were expressed in the contract to be in consideration of the sale of the sale shares and the obligations of the sellers herein. Now, that language wasn't conclusive, but it was a useful tag relied upon by the majority to say, look, it even says in the contract, this isn't just about the payment for the shares, it is about payment for the continued obligations. Now, those continued obligations included covenants in restraint of trade, which operated both during the currency of the SPA and then for a period post-termination. And that was clause 11.2. There was an issue at trial in front of Mr. Justice Burton about whether they were enforceable. He found that they were, and that issue was not the subject of an appeal. If an individual was in breach of the restraints of trade, then he became a defaulting shareholder. And there were two key provisions which were in issue in the Cavendish case. Clause 5.1, which said that a defaulting shareholder was not entitled to receive the interim or the final payment. And 5.6, which was a call option on the defaulting shareholder's shares, that he would have to sell the shares at net asset value, i.e. Giving no value for the goodwill in the business. The majority took the time to summarise some general principles. The penal nature of a clause depends on its purpose, ordinarily an inference from its effect. That is a question of construction, to which evidence of commercial background is relevant, but evidence of actual intention, as usual, irrelevant. Fine line. As a matter of construction, it's to be decided at the time that it is agreed, like the restraints of trade. And the classification of terms depends upon the substance of the term and not on its form or label. And they also said this, that there is a strong initial presumption of legitimacy where there is a negotiated contract between properly advised parties of comparable bargaining power. Now, in the employment world, it's perfectly legitimate to say that a senior executive has comparable bargaining power with his employer. That's entirely possible when they're negotiating sort of key parts of remuneration, for example. But of course, if that remuneration is subject to deferral on standard terms, there will have been, in that context, no specific negotiation about those terms, and they will not have the benefit of this strong initial presumption of legitimacy. Crucial in the explanation of the majority was the difference between primary and secondary obligations. Now, this is something that you may remember cropping up in photo production in Securicall or Diploc, but it's not a concept that is readily to our hands as part of the jurisprudence of contract law. And it doesn't really follow out very clearly from this judgment either. The majority said this: there's a fundamental difference between a jurisdiction to review the fairness of a contractual obligation and a jurisdiction to regulate the remedy for its breach. The penalty rule regulates only the remedies available for breach of a party's primary obligations, not the primary obligations themselves. So how do you know if it's a primary or a secondary obligation? A secondary obligation is here, where a contract contains an obligation on one party to perform an act and also provides that if he doesn't perform it, he will pay the other party a specified sum of money. The obligation to pay the specified sum is a secondary obligation. Well, that's fine, but that isn't the test, because we know that a primary or a secondary obligation may or may not involve the payment of a specified sum of money. So that is a definition, but it's not a sufficient definition. The definition of primary: there's no obligation to perform the act, but if one party does not perform, he will pay the other a specified sum. Again, I find this very difficult to understand in the context of Mr. McDessie. Could it really be said he had no obligation to comply with the covenants in restraint of trade? He just knew that if he didn't comply with them, he would be subject to these consequences. That appears to be what the Supreme Court's saying. It can't be right, though, because if Cavendish had wanted to get an injunction to stop him breaching the covenants in restraint of trade, they would have got one. So he did have an obligation not to breach them. So we get an attempt to articulate the difference between a primary and a secondary obligation, but it isn't very clear, and that will prove to be even more so in a moment. So what's the outcome? Well, on clause 5.1, that's the provision disentitling the defaulting shareholder to receive the interim and or the final payments. Neuberger and Sumption were prepared to assume without deciding, which I just find, I find it baffling when there's something that's been fully argued in front of the Supreme Court and is relevant to the case, that they say, well, we'll assume it, but we're not going to decide it. That's what you're there for. But they assume without deciding that a contractual provision may be a penalty if it disentitles the contract breaker from receiving a sum of money which would otherwise have been due to him. But, they say, what was this clause? Actually, it was a price adjustment clause. It wasn't a secondary provision. It was about the price to be paid for the shares. So if he complied with the covenants, the restraint of trade covenants, then he would be paid each of the tranches of consideration. If he decided to breach them, well, that was fine, but he was just going to get paid a lesser amount, effectively only the completion sum. So this was all about primary provisions, price adjustment. And Cavendish had a legitimate interest in the observance of the restrictive covenants, which extended beyond the recovery of the loss flowing from breach, had an interest in measuring the price of the business to its value. 5.6, the second clause, that was the requirement for the defaulting shareholder to sell the shares at net asset value. The majority reasoned like this: the price reflects the reduced price which Cavendish was prepared to pay for the acquisition of the business in circumstances where they could not count on the loyalty of the defaulting shareholder, and on severance, no goodwill could be attributable to his loyalty. The price formula had a legitimate function which had nothing to do with punishment. And then they say, as a sort of tag it on at the end, more fundamentally, and this is crucial in their reasoning, you would have thought, but it's at the end they say, more fundamentally, this was a primary obligation. They don't tell us how. So what do the others say on this point? Lord Mance doesn't say very much. He says, like 5.1, 5.6 amounts to a reshaping of the party's primary relationship. Hodge, he said this was not a primary obligation, but it was not unenforceable. So he takes a different view from Neuberger and Sumption. And Hodge is agreed with by two others. So we have a situation where we've got three of their lordships saying one thing, three of the lordships saying the other thing, and Mance not saying anything at all. And the further complication was that at the point of hand down, Lord Clark was silent on this point. He just said he agreed with everyone. But then when it was reported in the Weekly Law Reports, some keen eye noticed that he'd added in a phrase in his one paragraph judgment where he said, I agree with everyone. He'd added in, save in respect of this point, where he agrees with two. So you get 3-3 and an undecided. So 5-6, we've no idea whether it's a primary obligation or a secondary obligation, and we don't know how to work out which it is, and they didn't decide for us. So if you were confused by the outcome of that, you're in good hands. Moving then to the implication of terms. Marks and Spencer and BNP Paribas is a case which is, it's about a commercial lease, it's not very interesting on its facts, but it is extremely useful in taking forward the general principles that apply to the implication of terms. And they summarise these principles as follows. The proposed term must be reasonable and equitable. It must be necessary to give business efficacy to the contract so that no term will be implied if the contract is effective without it. It must be so obvious that it goes without saying. It must be capable of clear expression. And it must not contradict any express term of the contract. So that all sounds very familiar and has been reinforced, but with some additional observations. One is considering for these purposes the notional parties, not the actual people, again, not their actual intention, but what a notional party would have thought and agreed. Fairness is not the test. Having said that the proposed term must be reasonable and equitable, they say, well, that test probably doesn't really add anything. Having said that it needs to be have business efficacy and to be so obvious that it goes without saying, they go on to say that business efficacy and obviousness can be alternatives, although usually they will go hand in hand. And then when considering the question of necessity, It's a value judgment. There isn't a requirement for absolute necessity, but just necessity. Make of that what you will. Note as well that there was an acceptance in this case of something that Baroness Hale had said in the Gies case, at which Chris was in. She said that there are two types of implied term. There are those which are specified into the particular contract, and that's what this test is going to. And then there are those which are generally implied into contracts of a certain type, unless they're excluded. And the Supreme Court in this case reiterated that part, that even these general terms can be excluded by the express terms of the contract. So even those implied terms are not implied necessarily in every case, because no term can be implied which is inconsistent with the contract. And of course, the key general term that we all experience is trust and confidence, which is implied into every employment contract. But presumably, again, this issue arises, unless excluded. The next case deals with the incorporation of terms, a case called the Department for Transport and Sparks. And in deciding whether terms have been incorporated into a contract, so they're not expressly referred to in the primary document, but they are referred to by reference, in deciding whether or not they are incorporated, you go through this process. You discern the contractual intention of the parties. You do that by applying the normal principles of contractual construction. But you always have to consider, in any event, whether the term is apt for incorporation. So again, a nice, clear restatement of the general principles. And that approach was used by the court, upheld by the Court of Appeal, to incorporate a specific term which regulated cumulative short-term absences. And you look at the provision, and frankly, you wouldn't look at it and think it screams out something that would normally be incorporated into an employment contract. But they found that it was, and the reason for doing that was so that it could be said that the Department of Transport couldn't simply alter the policy by issuing a new policy in different terms. There had to be a contractual variation of it. So there has to be an effective contractual variation once these terms were incorporated. It means that one has to be even more alive to terms of an employee handbook to consider whether they might be incorporated. Do you really want them to be incorporated? Should they be expressed to be non-contractual? In Murphy and Beckton Energy, Mrs. Justice Carr had to consider what relevance could be assigned to the fact that certain words in a draft had been deleted. Now, she was prepared to accept that there was some relevance to the fact that words had been deleted. It provided relevant background at least. But this was in the context of a standard industry-wide contract, which everyone in the industry used, and certain words as a default, and certain words had been removed from it. She said you have to be very careful when you're drawing an inference from the fact that words have been deleted, but on the specific case, it was relevant background because it confirmed an interpretation that could be taken from the express language used in another part of the contract. So it was background to confirming the view that she was effectively about to reach in any event on the other terms of the contract. Where the words are simply deleted, you probably can't draw any inferences on that because you don't know why they've been deleted. They may have been deleted because everyone thought they were superfluous. They didn't need to be said because they were already there. Or perhaps they were deleted because they specifically wanted to depart from them. So one has to be very cautious in using words that have been deleted as a form of interpretation. Proving an oral agreement, quite a nice and slightly surprisingly forceful judgment in the case of Prometric and Cunliffe. On a summary judgment application, the court need not assume a factual finding in favour of the claimant, as normally happens, as happened in Paturel, for example. the claimant's asserted facts are accepted for the purposes of the hearing, you don't have to accept them if that finding would be inconsistent with the contemporaneous documents and wholly improbable. So if it really is an really improbable assertion on the part of the claimant, then the court can say that's so improbable, it's not going to be found at trial, and therefore I'm not going to have to assume it for the purposes of the summary judgment application. And this was in the context, on the facts of the case, it was in the context of a pension agreement. And the individual was saying, well, I had a chat with someone in HR at the time that I came over here, and we had a word in our ears, basically. And as a result of that, I was assured that the pension, specific pension terms that I'd enjoyed with my formerly were going to carry across, and I would continue to get the benefit of those. And the Court of Appeals said, that's just ridiculous. Someone who is a businessman of great experience would not simply allow something to stay as an oral agreement. Even if there was some form of oral agreement, he would want to ensure that it was written down in some way. So the court just knocked the case out at the summary judgment stage. Really quite a useful case if you're battling a rather weak claim, where the cards seem to be rather stacked against one. But this judgment, I think, is very helpful in taking a realistic approach as to what should and shouldn't be assumed by the court for the purposes of that hearing. Next is accepting a repudiatory breach. Judgment MSC Mediterranean Shipping and Cotonex. We know, again from Gies, that the innocent party to a repudiatory breach has a choice whether or not to accept the repudiation. But what the Cotonex judgment does is to consider that there may be circumstances in which that discretion is controlled. It is another case involving a control of a discretion. And Mr. Justice Leggett specifically makes that analogy. He said, I'm not talking here about a contractual discretion, because I'm talking about a discretion conferred by the general law, whether or not to accept a repudiatory breach. But I think the principles are comparable. And so, if the innocent party has no reasonable reason for continuing the contract, then he may not do so. And effectively, the contract has to come to an end. And in this case, a ship charterer was trying to keep the goods on board the ship for much longer than he needed to, just as a way not of covering himself from losses, but as a way actually of making a form of profit. And Leggett said that that was a wholly unreasonable approach for that party to take, and it should have accepted the repudiatory breach, and the contract should have been brought to an end. So it's an interesting case about the development of rationality as part of a contractual discretion, even if it's a contractual discretion conferred by the general law. Mr. Justice Leggett also referred in his judgment to an increasing recognition of an implied term of good faith. Now, of course, for employment lawyers, we have that. We have the trust and confidence term. But if you're involved in cases slightly outside the employment sphere, where there is a relational contract, and that's the language that has been developed, in relational cases, then there may well be an implied duty to act in good faith. And Mr. Justice Leggett, it's one of these judgments where he says there's an increasing recognition of this implied term. It is an increasing recognition largely done almost exclusively by him, and he's sort of reinforcing his own jurisprudence. A very interesting case on Rotherham Park damages. Maurice Garner and One Step Support Limited. It broadens effectively the circumstances in which a party can claim Rotherham Park damages, because what the Court of Appeal said is that it is not a requirement, as had been said in some previous authorities, it is not a requirement that it is impossible to prove actual financial losses from the breach. The question, the overarching question for the court, is whether justice requires an award of Rotherham Park damages. Is that what justice requires? And it's a matter for the judge. And the judge may take into account a range of factors, but they can include the difficulty in proving loss. Doesn't need to be impossible, but if it's difficult, then that's obviously going to assist in establishing the exercise of discretion in favour of Rotherham Park damages. And also he took into account, the trial judge took into account in this case, that the conduct of the individuals in effectively hiding their conduct for a long period so that the innocent party couldn't seek injunctive relief, so a deliberate hiding of their conduct to avoid interim relief being given, was a very strong factor in favour of giving Rotherham Park damages, so that the innocent party had some sort of effective remedy other than the limited damages which they would otherwise have been able to get. And a final important point from the case is that when you're on an interim application and the question before the court is are damages an adequate remedy, that is asking about normal damages. It is not asking about Rotherham Park damages. So you discount at the interim stage the possibility of Rotherham Park damages. The party that's potentially going to be injuncted cannot say they've got an adequate remedy because even if they can't prove their losses, they'll get an award of Rotherham Park damages. You can't take that approach. So again, it's a useful clarification of the correct approach on an interim application. And finally, one little case which might prove to be useful to you when you're faced with endless repetitious and expensive correspondence, and obviously you would never be the author of that type of correspondence. So remember this case so that you can deploy it against your opponents. The judge there said, Mr. Justice Edward Stewart, it is no longer acceptable, if it ever was, for parties to pursue issues or applications that have no real impact on the issues that are central to the dispute. Further, it is no longer acceptable for solicitors to carry on a war of attrition by correspondence, whether instructed to do so or not. It is the parties who are the subject of the duty in CPR 1.3, not merely their solicitors. So we have a positive obligation not to continue in side correspondence, which is really just a war of attrition, and actually we've just got to get on and deal with the issues. Now, this was a case in the Technology and Construction Court, but I see no reason at all why it can't be deployed in employment cases as well, particularly where there is often an enormous disparity between the resources of the former employer and the employee. And this correspondence I've seen being used effectively to wear down the resources of the individual employee. So they can bring up this case and say, look, I'm not going to engage in this correspondence. It's a complete waste of my time. Let's just get on with the issues. And now you've got some court support for that firm view. Thanks very much.